So what is that?
Have a dog?
What?
Squat.
Also because of the old days. Yes, the old days there was.
Dear God.
There was. There is nothing which you would say which should phase the Amoraim. Yes, it's brought down in the Gemara.
Dear God.
Yes.
How did you go out with your sister, like the pizza or some movies?
That's okay.
Even though it might look like.
You shouldn't go to movies.
What about movies? Like a pizza.
Is that why
my
Yitzhak
Novel wants to have a story?
What?
Is that why some people don't have
to? I don't think that's why. I think there's just a negative connotation because in Europe, you know, the dogs are set against the Jews as opposed to Jews having dogs.
So
I think
it's totally different. The dogs are set against
I heard cats are
reincarnated. I think Jews are more prone to have cats than dogs, but
although they weren't Egyptian deities.
Yeah. So,
cats aren't mentioned once in the Bible.
Okay, so we are moving right along from that topic now that the younger set has moved in. Here we are at the end of verse 15. The it says "V'tzedek tishpod am Yisrael."
661.
In justice, you should judge your friend. Amisecha is somebody who's together with you, somebody who's in your am, who's in your nation. Now, Rabbi Hirsch points out a fascinating paradox in the way the rabbis approach this term. On one hand, the simple meaning is that when you have a court, it should be a court of justice. In other words, you shouldn't have an agenda which you're trying as a judge, we mentioned this last week, but rather you should do what justice demands of you. And that's why the verse previously had said, you know, don't be swayed by your desire to give honor to a great person, to give money to a poor person. You've got to judge everything with a even sense of justice. Yet, the other explanation the rabbis give, which the article probably brings down, or the article in front of me, is that when if you have a person who you can judge right positively or negatively, you're always supposed to try and judge them positively.
That's from Rashi and Sanhedrin 34b.
Rashi also says it here, but I'm impressed. I had no idea that the Rashi Pro people knew not just Shas, but Rashi on Shas. That's very, very impressive.
What? Did
you
hear someone?
I don't know. I don't have an answer in front of me. Don't spoil it.
Yeah.
That actually means that you're supposed to incline towards judging somebody favorably. I had this story like this just today. For years and years, whenever I traveled down the West Side Highway, I would notice on my left assumedly was the West Side Eruv, and it was definitely no good. Clearly no good.
This is West Side?
The Upper West Side Manhattan.
Okay.
Is there any other West Side?
No.
So it was clearly no good. And I was shocked, and I was, but I never said anything because I'm not, you know, oh well. There are many people who don't keep kosher Eruvin. Today I happened to get an email which was in the name of the rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue, and it was about the Eruv around Manhattan. Now, in the early 50s, there was an Eruv which was built around the entire city of Manhattan. The entire city, entire borough, entire island of Manhattan. They didn't actually do very much construction at all. What they did was they relied primarily on the seawalls, meaning that there was actually, for most of Manhattan Island, there was an artificial pier or boundary to the island. There weren't beaches. There aren't any beaches in Manhattan, so far as I know. And therefore, you actually have a wall which surrounds Manhattan, and therefore
you have a walled city.
You have a walled city, right. Some postmen didn't like this arrangement because, actually, of the bridges, which go over the walls, and the question whether the bridges negate the walls, because obviously you have many, many people traveling on the bridges over these walls, in fact, perhaps probably enough to constitute a public domain. So but there was a rabbi, a distinguished rabbi, who was several distinguished rabbis who, in the late 40s, early 50s, tried to maintain the Eruv. And in fact, there was a rabbi in the early years of the 50s, and I don't know how much longer, used to go around Manhattan Island on the Circle Line cruise and check out to make sure the Eruv was in existence. Now, officially, this Eruv was in existence till this very day, from the 1950s till now.
Wow.
And officially, one therefore could carry, if one relied on this Eruv, throughout the entire island of Manhattan without any concern or any problem. Now, we have all known all these many years that this is a bunch of baloney. Nevertheless, there was one of the responsibilities of one of the rabbis on the Upper West Side, traditionally the rabbi of the Jewish Center, was to officially certify this Eruv as being a kosher Eruv. And ostensibly, only the rabbi would know where the Eruv ran. It was a secret which was passed down from generation to generation in order that nobody should come and,
Why is the Eruv so good? Why doesn't this Manhattan Eruv work?
Because the walls are not, there aren't consistent walls around Manhattan. There aren't consistent walls. And we have not seen that the place where the walls don't exist, that they're actually constructed, through poles and wires. So, but in any event, so today, and the email went out that the rabbis got together and they decided, quote unquote, that the Eruv can no longer be maintained. It has become too difficult to maintain, and therefore they dropped it. I see people getting firmer as years go by. So I wrote an email to the rabbi in Lincoln Square saying, this, once we're on the topic, you should know that the Eruv and the Upper West Side, if this is the Eruv, seems to have been possible for many, many years. And he said to me, what is it now?
Is it possible times back in Manhattan?
Most of the time dark in Manhattan, because there's a lot of tall buildings and they make a lot of shadows.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he wrote back to me that this is not actually part of the present West Side Eruv. This is part of the old Eruv, which is defunct. So I really, all these years I have been judging these people disfavorably, assuming that everybody on the West Side was a sinner. They probably are, but this wasn't the sin they were committing. So that actually is a classic case of where you're supposed to be don somebody the cops cruz. If you have a possibility of judging somebody favorably, positively, or disfavorably, negatively, even if the balance is inclined towards the negative, towards the not favorable outlook, you're supposed to bend over backwards and try and judge the person favorably. And that's what this pasuk is telling us over here, according to the second interpretation. Now, this seems to be a direct paradox. On the one hand, we're told that in court, one is supposed to have an absolute, even keel, perfectly balanced sense of judgment, and yet outside the court, we're supposed to take a completely different view and try and find as much possible merit for any individual that we possibly can. Does anybody here see that as a paradox?
Is it trying to teach us that our own perceptions, our own personal perceptions, can be very biased, and so it's better that we can live in concord with people than discord?
Well, what happens to the person when he sits on injustice as a judge?
Oh, but then at least you have the you're a lot more well versed in the Torah, like you possibly have witnesses,
and
so you have ways of converging evidence towards the truth, whereas just by your own self, like, they're assuming you're biased, and therefore it's better to be in concord than discord.
But what you're saying, it's an interesting idea, which is that when you have the setting of the court with all of the accoutrements, all the additional aspects of the court proceedings, that actually that would make it more, you make you more capable of being unbiased or level-headed, both outside the court, where there's much more difficult.
We're not appointed to be judges in our everyday life. Like, when you ask people, like, how good or bad someone is, when you ask a from Jewish person how good or bad somebody is, then they're going to say, who am I?
Most from people wouldn't say that.
No,
it's wrong religion. theory, they should be right.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily happen.
But even if we're judging people, even if we have the whole truth, we're still not supposed to judge them.
We still judge unfavorably.
No, actually, not necessarily. I'm going to come to that in a couple of minutes. But by the way, I have to tell you, a few weeks ago, I was in Ottawa for a wedding, and the parliament was closed because Abbas was visiting Ottawa that day. So
he's the new Palestinian.
So he went to the Canadian Supreme Court, and all the justices in Canada, when they sit in session, they all look like Santa Claus. They all wear this red and white. Have you seen that ever?
Sorry, so where were you again?
Canadian Supreme Court.
You took a vacation.
In Ottawa. No, what's the case for a wedding? One of the boys that got married to a girl from Ottawa.
Wedding in Ottawa. And you went to Supreme Court. Okay.
Have you ever seen a robe that they wear?
That's the old British
dress. Red and white. Canadian colors. So that's a possibility that when you're in court, you have a much more, much better chance of actually judging a person on an even keel, unbiased. Would you want? Should I say something
more? Outside of court, you don't have all the information, so there's no.
So you're more likely to be.
More likely to be biased.
Okay, that's one possibility. Not where I've heard this, but this is a good possibility. Yeah.
I would say because when you're in court, your judgment has a physical action attached to it. Like if you find him guilty, then he has to say money, or he goes guilty. Right? Something's going to happen to him because of your judgment. Whereas outside the court, if I judge that someone is a sinner, I think that guy violated Shabbos. So I can't just kill him myself, right? So what purpose is it for me to think that about him? Like it doesn't have any resultant effect. So therefore, it's just going to make me hate him, which is you're not supposed to hate your fellow Jew because I'm going to dislike him because I'm
seeing that's the interesting idea. It's really
so therefore, since I can't do anything about it anyway, I might as well judge him as favorably as possible, and then I'll still like him. And then if he's in court and gets killed, I'm like, oh, I was right,
That's really the antithesis of what he said. Almost antithetical. Because you're saying that in court, we should be as mean to the guy as possible.
That's right.
Because we have the means to carry out the sentence. And whereas out of court, since we don't have the means to do anything, there's no point. That's the reason there's a Gemara which supports that contention to a certain extent, which says that a certain person came to court to say that his name was Zogi. I think it's a funny name. It says Gemara Makos. He came to court and he testified that Tuvia, another guy, sinned. And they whipped the guy who came to court to testify that Tuvia sinned. And the guy said, Tuvia Chotav is Bigud Mangid. Tuvia is the guy who sinned. You're whipping me. Where's the justice? So they said to him, no, you are a solitary witness. Therefore, your testimony is unacceptable. Hence, your coming to court is merely an act of
slander.
Russian hara. Rechilus.
And there's one witness there, right.
So therefore, we have no evidence that Tuvia, no, it's not insufficient evidence for Tuvia to be flawed, but you were going to flaw because you just came to court and told us Lashon Hara.
when you slander someone, though, like, you might not see a direct cause and effect relationship, but, like, there are things that can happen. Like, when you hold an attitude, like a disfavorable attitude towards someone, like the face, for example, like let's say you, Rabbi Bachofer, God forbid, think someone's a sinner. So when you're in like close contact with them, like you're talking with them face to face, your face might betray that sort of feeling, and then they might feel bad about themselves because you are transmitting this sort of seedy underbelly of suspicion to them, and a lot of things could happen from that. Not to mention the spiritual consequences which could happen. Like my rabbi told me an interesting story that for some reason he spoke Lashon Hara against the Holy Yeshiva, and he took it upon himself, because he recognized the wrong that he did, he took it upon himself to travel down to that yeshiva and say sorry to everybody.
Wow.
Even though, they didn't...
That's very impressive.
They didn't know. Like, what did they know? But, like, his Lashon Hara could have some kind of effect on them.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying now is that a person outside in court, he's not supposed to demonstrate any favoritism, and therefore we don't care really about his countenance, but outside of court, since we're concerned about his relationship with his fellow Jew, telling him, judge him favorably in order that you should not look askance at him and have that cause negative.
Well, it's not that we shouldn't show favoritism per se,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not saying, like, do the exact opposite, be the meanest again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, like, you have a reason to be suspicious,
mm-hmm.
but on the other hand, you also have a reason not to be, like, overly, overly suspicious,
mm-hmm.
I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The, Rabbi Hirsch says an interesting thing. He says, actually it's quite simple what he says. He says that the two different interpretations here are precisely consistent with what is best for society. Meaning, it's best for society that, and that's what tzedek is. Tzedek, he says, is what is what we call in English social justice. Not justice in and of itself. It's social justice. What's social justice? It means what is best for society. What's best for society is to have courts which are completely balanced and unbiased, and it's best for society that the individual citizens be biased to look at their, and disposed to look at their friends favorably. So that is considered to be the aspect of tzedek. Now it's important. Social justice, tzedek, is not always the same as emet. I think we've touched on this before, but perhaps it bears a repeating. You're allowed to lie and you're encouraged to lie when it's going to create more social justice, right? In fact, I love, let's say in this case with his rabbi, if I told Lashon Hara about Ron, right? And I said, Ron is a jerk, he's an idiot, he's disgusting, he's revolted. And I said that to Justin. I'm not supposed to go to Ron and say to Ron, I should go to Ron and say, Ron, I told Lashon Hara about you, can you please forgive me? But I should not. So Jamal should not press me, nor should I tell him what I said, because that's going to make the situation much worse.
Really?
So therefore, you're not necessarily required to be absolutely truthful, even when you're coming to ask mechila from somebody, because that person might not be mechila. You say, I said something bad, something not so good, right? So that's one aspect of it. And of course, we have several other aspects, the most famous one of being when Yaakov steals the brachas from Esav, right? When Yaakov steals the brachas from Esav, so this, of course, is not emet. In the classic sense, the truest sense of the word emet, but it is tzedek. So that we have to look whatever is just. And justice dictates to us that there should be a different standard in the courtroom than there is outside the courtroom.
So we don't say the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We just say the truth and...
In court, yes.
Whatever.
No, they always say it in court.
In court,
yes. In court, you have to tell the truth, the whole truth.
Outside of court, not the whole truth.
Absolutely.
Sometimes
not
even the truth.
Right.
If someone asks you...
What?
If Ron comes up to you and says, did you say I am a jerk to Justin?
You should try and get out of it.
You say, I did say something bad.
I said something bad, but I don't remember quite what.
What does that make you look like then?
What?
What does that make you look like then?
Careful.
Yeah.
So based on your example with the error, are you up again?
My
fundamental attitude toward Arab is never tell anybody Arab is possible.
Okay.
Unless they ask.
Why?
Because most Arabin were built by some rabbi. And that brings a person, the regular, you know, balabas, the regular layman, into a great quandary and difficult situation. How, as you know, which rabbi is telling the truth and which is not?
Okay.
And that is why Erevin becomes very often the subject of dispute and, contention. Because there are always rabbis involved on both sides.
There's some rabbis.
What?
Rabbi.
Yeah, so unfortunately, rabbis have an extremely, extremely vested interest in having Erevin in their communities. So therefore, they will bend over backwards very often to have Erevin, even if the Erevin are not completely kosher.
Oh.
And there are certain rabbis with long white beards all around the United States who go about and build Erevin, and they have no clue as to the laws of Erevin. But nevertheless, since they have long white beards, therefore, they are considered to be trustworthy.
I'm sure there are long black hair skirts who also go around pulling
out. I don't think they care about it.
They don't care about
it. No, I don't think so.
That's why publishers never get involved there.
Rabbis with long
white beards. I asked a Chabad rabbi once, I said, why don't you build an arrow here? It's so easy. The place is so small, and they just need to build an arrow. And then all these Jews want to carry it. And he said, as good as that will be, the Chabad policy, don't build Erevin, and you don't get involved in Erevin.
he wasn't telling you the truth.
At least on the West Coast.
He wasn't telling you the truth.
No?
First of all, it's not Chabad policy. Chabad policy is that they build Erevin, but don't tell anybody they built it.
Yeah.
Everybody. Yeah, that's what the Rebbe said. Rebbe said, we don't want people to carry, but
right.
we don't want people to sin either. So they have to build an Erevin, don't tell anybody about it.
Mm.
That's what the Chabad policy.
Geez.
Right. The but in fact nowadays what's happening across the country, including California, but
yeah.
No, because I have an uncle in Long Beach who has built an Eruv, is that the Chabad rabbis are being pressured into building Eruvin because their congregations are not completely Chabad,
right.
And they see that their friend, you know, down the road has got an Eruvin and is joining Shabbos that much more. So therefore, the Chabad rabbis also bring up Eruvin for their constituents nowadays.
Mm.
So I don't know how many years ago that was, but.
In South Africa, was like the certain parts was like very ghetto. Like there's a whole lot of areas which are very, very big. You know, which is the majority of the Jews are staying in, right?
Like Muncie.
Yeah. Kind of. And there, like a lot of them have Arabim, and like the Chabad community will be among them, so they'll have a proper Arab, and the non-Chabad people will be even using the Arab, will be a kosher Arab, but they still won't use the Arab. I'll say that.
That's Africa's an even different case because they're all neighborhoods.
Yeah. Okay. It's just better. There's nothing we can do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a Bible trouble never use there because the rather hell not to use there. The,
At all.
I think maybe
bungalow
colonies, maybe, but not. Most of them.
Wait,
they
build
Arabin,
but they
yeah.
don't use So they believe that when they build an Arab, they're making people not sit on Shabbos by carrying. But at the same time, they don't hold that
sheet up.
Just in case.
The Rebbe told them it's not, you know, there's an interesting perspective, which is, you know, which is the question of the debated for thousands of years already. What's more Shabbatic? What's more in the spirit of Shabbat? Is more in the spirit of Shabbat to carry and enjoy the Shabbat in that respect? Or is more Shabbatic to refrain from carrying and in order to retain that sense of restriction?
I say refrain.
Okay, so the Rebbe and you were on the same side. Okay? The way it happened, though, over time, we should know, Lubavitch Rebbe notwithstanding, what happened is this generally became a divide between Hasidim and Mishnagdim. Can you guess which side took which perspective?
I don't know. All the Hasidim here are still there.
Right. Because the Hasidim felt if it's going to facilitate happiness on Shabbos, that's
right.
Good. But the Lubavitch felt, you know, happiness. What is Shabbos and Lubavitch? You don't want to be happy, right?
According to the Litvox, what's wrong with happiness on Shabbos?
Are you starting with Litvox now, Canada?
I don't know. The Orsvach show on Shabbos. It's like a funeral in there. Funeral.
We're talking about the show over here?
Yeah.
By listen with this way in standards, it's downright giddy here.
Heavenly Ball's a carnival. I think if someone smiles in there, that you think, what, this is shining? You there.
Ouch.
Haven't
you been here with their exuberant dancing on Friday night?
Exuberant.
You mean you walk around in a circle? Grudgingly?
Yeah.
Exuberant is the car off when he has the cut off.
The,
yeah.
Norm, down the court.
The question of
happiness doesn't arise in Lithuanian thought to the same extent as in the Hasidic thought.
Why? So
because you know there's in Kiruv very often the hook with which they draw people in is we're going to teach you how to be happy. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. Have you? Because
yeah.
Like back in the Eshet Torah, especially the big thing. You know, we'll teach you how to be happy.
Okay.
Like being made Jewish. So that is a non-Lithuanian approach. Lithuanian approach is you don't have to be happy, right? You just have to do what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to accomplish things in life, whether you're happy or not.
Forget things that.
Right, right. It's not so meaningful, right?
That's why the Lithuanians weren't so.
Excuse me.
So that's why the Lithuanians weren't so successful in Kiruv. It seems like.
Right. That's why the Hasidic methodology is much more popular in Kiruv because you know you're coming to somebody who might be leading a carefree life full of pleasure and telling him, no, that's not what it's all about. You have to be morose and miserable like the rest of us.
Sign me up. Get to miserable and morose together. But at least I'll be doing something.
So that doesn't always work, but, you know, me personally, myself, I have more of an inclination towards Lithuanian perspective than the Hasidic perspective. I mean, Also, Lubavitch, in its classic form, not the modern form which it took, is a Lithuanian Hasidus. There are two Lithuanian Hasidus, which are Lubavitch and Slonim. And the way you can tell is that their songs... Their songs, when they have a tish or something like that, their songs sound like funeral dirges. Right, so they're very haunting and sometimes depressing melodies. That is an indication of the Lithuanian Hasidus. So it's not an oxymoron. They do exist. Yes.
Is the happiness real, or is it just to get people in the door?
No, Hasidim are generally happier people. I think it's demonstrable that they're happier people. They're more carefree. They're more easygoing.
Is that the right way?
They're more strict in dressing all the same and just doing everything for Judaism and not being involved in...
Well, what happened was, an interesting phenomenon is that Hasidus became less individualized.
Right.
Became more, under the mass movement. And a mass movement is less individual challenge responsibility. You can be happier. So I think that's an attraction. Be part of something which just doesn't require me anymore to make major changes or to accomplish major things. That's part of it. How do we get on this topic of happiness? We're not talking about happiness because we're talking about Erev, because we're talking about judging people favorably. That's how we got there. There are a couple of interesting things. First of all, Chafetz Chaim said that a person, when you're supposed to be dan, the Hebrew word is dan lekas zechus. Actually, say the name of Chafetz Chaim, I never saw it inside. But dan lekas zechus means judge towards the balance of merit. So the Chafetz Chaim is supposed to have said you should be dan lekas zechus, judge to the balance of merit, but not lekas shtus, not to the balance of idiocy. Meaning you don't have to go so far out on a limb and assume that a person is being a good person, and 99% of the evidence indicates the opposite.
Like if they're burying a body, you don't have to say, oh, maybe they're just helping with soil.
Take the body out of the truck.
Clearing out the soil.
The body's going to bury it properly.
It depends. The study,
Well, not necessarily, but he's not just a Russian, because many people are Rishonim, but rather if he's an evildoer. Russian evildoer are not the same thing. A person is supposed to judge favorably when there is a reasonable doubt.
Hmm.
But when there isn't a reasonable doubt, even if there is the possibility of a doubt, at that point one no longer has the obligation to judge people favorably. At that point one has to be more realistic, because it's also not so good to be not a realist. Therefore you have to be somewhat somewhat skeptical and not completely, naive. That's an important point that Chafetz Chaim made. And Chafetz Chaim was, of course, one of the greatest people in terms of judging favorably and always inclined towards merit, but he said there's a limit even to that. Another interesting thing, which I wanted to bring up about this... Where are we going home in a few minutes? About less than 10. Okay? Another
a double session to the
Okay. He's being home.
This is all recorded.
Oh my goodness. Four of our kids are home for the summer.
Oh,
that's tough.
Yeah,
it's
around
with you. He's in camp during the day, so that's good, right?
Yeah.
There's an interesting Chazon Ish, of course, was a very great a rabbi in the mid-20th century, and he actually was anti-Musar. He was anti-Musar.
Strange.
Yeah, Chazon Ish.
Why?
Nowadays, you don't hear that term because it's not politically correct. Anybody thinks that everybody was pro-Musar, or rather there's been some historical revisionism. But there was a tremendous battle in the late 19th and early 20th century between the Mussar and anti-Mussar forces in the Lithuanian yeshiva world. And the anti-Mussar forces were of the opinion that Mussar, meaning specific concentration on personal growth and one's character traits and one's relationships with others and with God, is debilitating. It has a negative effect, not a positive effect. In other words, just learn it, don't worry. That was basically the approach. Just learn what the halacha says, just learn Gemara, and don't worry about your personal character traits because they're just going to go nuts. And one of the things that the Muslim movement, particularly in the town of Nevarik, and the yeshivas which came out of Nevarik, focused on, Nevarik was a major chain of Muslim yeshivas in Eastern Europe, was on noting how low a person can be. There's a famous joke in the yeshiva world that a new bacher comes to the Nevarik yeshiva, and he sees two guys learning Musa together, two older bachers. And one bacher says to the other bacher, I am nothing, I am a zero, I am worthless. And the second bacher says to the first bacher, you say, you're nothing, I'm less than zero, I'm despicable, I'm much less than worthless. So the new guy comes in and says, nope, when the Nevarik, do as the Nevarikers do. So he says, sits down and says, saying, I'm worthless, I'm meaningless, my life is empty. So one older bacher says to the other older bacher, look at him, he just got here and already he's a zero. So this was one of the stereotypical Nevarikers was a person who attempted to identify their negative traits and the things which caused them to be coarse or base, and then to work on them. But it required identifying them, and that required a lot of soul-searching and caused a lot of anguish and feelings, you know, complex feelings of guilt, of difficulty, things like that. Other Muslim schools were not that way. But the Nevarik was like that. And the Chazish came in direct contact with Nevarik. And one of the things Nevarik was particularly concerned with was Negiah. And Negiah, nowadays, contemporary terms, means contact between man and woman, right? But Negiah in classic yeshiva terms and Muslim terms means a vested interest. Meaning, am I able to make a clear, lucid, objective decision? Or is what I do tainted by my Negiah, by my contact with this issue, meaning by my vested interest, my agenda, which clouds my view and distorts my perception? And this was a tremendous point of Nevarik HaMussar, that people see things from their own personal perspective. They are not, very often, not capable of seeing things objectively, of seeing truth, because they're looking out from within themselves and not seeing what objective perspective should lead them to see. And the Chazon Ish became
infuriated
is a good word, by this perspective.
Yeah.
By the way, there's a fictionalized account of the Chazon Ish's interactions with the Mussar movement called the Yeshiva. The Yeshiva was written by a Yiddish author whose name was Chaim Grader. Chaim Grader was a yeshiva bacher who learned in Nevarik and who was one of the shamashim, one of the people who was very close to the Chazon Ish. And later on, he became Nafru. And he has his most famous work is a work with yeshiva bacher and another guy who became Nafrum, who both went through the Second World War, meet on the park bench in Paris and have a tremendous debate. My Quarrel was searched something, or I forget exactly what the name of it, also was made into a movie, and that was like his famous work. And he was supposed to be the second guy, and Yeshiva Bach was supposed to be an old acquaintance of his. So, but then he has this other work. What is it, Noah? I'm almost finished.
I just want to ask you something. I need to tell you something. It's a joke that I made up.
Not
somebody was just a three, was 7 years old school, was just learning Torah, and it's his first time learning Torah, and then you go up to your Rebbe, and before he even tells you something about Torah, you say, you say that you're supposed to wear a yarmulke.
Oh, okay, fine. That's right. 3 years old after we taught that that's the way yarmulke.
Yeah, but he already knew it.
Oh, we did already know. Okay. So he wrote this fictionalized account of the, which is fascinating reading, really is fascinating reading, called the Yeshiva, about his encounters with the Nevada Kri Yeshiva world and with the Chazon Ish and their encounters with each other. And you can read whole sections which later appeared in the Chazon Ish's works, like 30 years later, are here in this book, which Chaim Grader wrote, you know, and actually published as a novel, you know, of the Chazon Ish's thoughts. And it's interesting because this figure, it's an autobiographical novel, and the figure who represents Chaim Grader in the book, it's actually named Chaim, as the book ends, he is deliberately and consciously making the decision to leave Frumkite. And he's sitting on the banks of the river outside Vilna with a friend of his who's also leaving Frumkite, and they're both learning at a Musi Yeshiva in the Vardic, and the friend says to him, you know what, the problem is that we're never going to be happy. Because we're not going to be happy with Frumkite, but when we get to the outside world and we start, we even indulge ourselves in all the pleasures of the world, we're never going to be happy either. Because we know that it's empty and frivolous, so we're damned no matter what. He writes that as he was leaving, it's an amazing way of ending the book, he writes as he's leaving the yeshiva world, he says that, nevertheless, the picture, the paragon of what human accomplishment can be in this world remains for him, and he remembers, being reminded this from a perspective of 30 years later, when he's already been non-religious for many, many years, remain for him the Chazon Ish. So again, the figure in the book who represents Chazon Ish, which is, you know, basically has the same name, so almost identical, it's obvious. So it's interesting that he retained that sense, that the Chazon Ish was for him the ideal model of what a human being can accomplish. So what the Chazon Ish, Rav Chazon Ish has a whole discussion in one of his books, which actually Grader brings down in the Yeshiva, about bribery. And bribery is prohibited in a Jewish court. Right? We spoke about this. So the Chazon Ish says, bribery, the prohibition of bribery is a chok. It's not a mishpat. What's a chok? Right, a non-rational law, one which is not apparently rational, as opposed to rational law. And he says, I'll prove it to you, because a rabbi is not allowed to take money to sit on a court and judge litigants. He can't take money from a litigant. But the same rabbi, if he has to judge whether a chicken is kosher or not, he's allowed to take money from the guy who comes and asks him the question. What's the difference? If bribery is forbidden, then it should be just as forbidden to take money for judging whether chicken is kosher as it is for judging whether Reuven owes Shimon money. And yet it's not. So the Chazon Ish says that obviously bribery in of itself is not understandable. It's the prohibition that is not understandable. It's only that the Torah said, decreed for whatever reason, and it's a chok, it's not apparently obvious, that a judge may not take bribes. Why was Moshe Chazanish's agenda in saying this? His agenda was because the Musarniks, which he was opposing, held that a person is always bribed by his own personal agenda and his own personal interest. And therefore, he can never have a proper perspective on anything. And that's very debilitating, because that means you can never come to a decision. Because you'll never know whether the decision is right, it's logical, or maybe it's because I have my personal agenda. So Chazon Ish was strongly opposed to that. He saw that that had a very negative impact on people, and that, I assume, is why he was so adamant in saying that shochad, even bribery itself, where it is not just a covert or subtle interest, but overt and blatant purchase of interest, that is a hope. It's not necessarily the case that any person would be automatically swayed by that and therefore forbidden to sit in judgment. Nevertheless, it's sort of forbidden because, for whatever reason, it's not a good idea, it's not a good role model, whatever the case may be. But it's not inherently in and of itself something which automatically causes a person to be biased. So here you have an interesting perspective of Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish's perspective was such that he held that a person has the capacity, which also becomes a big machlokes, big issue in Judaism. Does a person have an absolute, complete capacity to be objective, or is a person always, by definition, subjective? And that also that comes back to some of what you said before. Your perspective was that a person is really always subjective. In a court of law, he comes as close to objectivity as possible, right? The Chazanish held that it's possible for a person to separate himself, make himself objective, and that the prohibition of bribery is therefore a hook. Yeah.
It's sort of interesting, the perspective of the Musar people with the Negios. It reminds me of this like philosophy called radical skepticism, where they believed, like, you know, the truth is subjective, nobody has the ability to be objective, so we have to question everything.
That was the radical perspective.
And that, I think, I can sort of reason that, again, the Chazon Ish would have thought that a bit gone, so to speak. Uh-huh. Because if nobody can be objective, then how do we even know there's a God?
Right. There was the only way that he would know about it would be by some, you know, revelation basically. There would be no logic to it in itself. There's no logic could ever be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
Basically. So the that was one point I wanted to make about that, which I forgot.
Well, isn't the Chazon Ish stuff the grandfather or something of one of our roles?
No, the great uncle. Great uncle. Yeah, great uncle. Rabbi's
Okay,
well, I forgot what else I wanted to say, so we'll have to stop here.
Thank you, Rabbi.